Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Klink.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's a Need to Know podcast. All thanks to the CIA Ops patron community. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, N2K Podcast, and online at ciaops.podbean.com.
Welcome along to the Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and you join me for episode 264. So remember that you can get access to all this information, everything that's happened with the Need to Know podcast, if you follow us on the Twitter at N2K Podcast and send us any feedback at needtoknow.cloud. Some of the challenges of late with the podcast have been finding suitable guests. So if you do know anybody, a bit of a shout out at the top of the episode here to please get in contact with me, director@ciaops.com. And have any suggestions, let me know if you're interested in coming on the podcast talking about anything to do with the Microsoft Cloud, business or technology. Love to hear from you. Again, would only require, 30 to 40 minutes. We have a bit of discussion and it's quite easy. No real dramas in it. Love to hear from people out there. So again, running a bit low on trying to find guests for the podcast. So if you do know someone or you can suggest someone you'd like to hear from, please let me know by all means. And it does make it easier for me to go and get those people for you to go and listen to. So with that, let me throw into the news. Now, it has been also a bit quiet of late. Now, I think a lot of that's got to do with the upcoming Microsoft Ignite. So next week, first week in March, we will once again have a 48-hour virtual conference, Microsoft Ignite. Now, this basically was run about 6 months ago, and because it would be too much to try and run a replacement of the in-person IT pro style Microsoft event called Ignite in 4 days. It's going to be much easier to split it over the two periods. So that's exactly what Microsoft have done. And we're about to get the second offering here next week. So I think a bit of the news has gone quiet. Obviously, people waiting and holding that for release this week as it comes out in the first week of March. Now, if you do want to register for that and you want to see what sessions are available, remember that they are recorded. But if you do want to interact directly when it is actually happening, go to myignite.microsoft.com, sign in, and then nominate the sessions that you would like to go and see. Now, lots of IT pro stuff, lots of developer stuff as well, Azure, Microsoft 365. So again, go through, have a look at all the sessions there, pick the ones you want. But generally what I do and I find works well is that I'll have it on in the background and they have sort of a live feed and they'll tell you what sessions are coming up. And then I will pop in and watch those sessions if they catch my attention. However, if there are some that I really want to see, I'll certainly mark those and make sure that I'm available to see those. And again, remember, after the event, we can always go back and have a look at them. Now, this is a very different event because it is virtual. Normally, there is a very, very large conference in Orlando, and it generally has been of a deeper content than what we see in this sort of event. So there has been some criticism around the depth of the content, how it's become more sales orientated than technically orientated. But judge for yourself. I think it's Microsoft's done a fantastic job to obviously get it up and running, do all logistics, do a pivot in a short period of time. And it's difficult to provide a level of content suitable for everybody. Remember that this is a free event, so you'll be able to attend without having to pay a fee. And again, that's very hard to target the information to that audience. So again, it's never going to be the same as an in-person event. Microsoft, I think, has done an admirable job getting it as close as possible given the virtual restrictions that we have now. It'll be very interesting to see maybe another 12 months whether we have gone back to in-person events. We'll just have to cross our fingers and wait. But for now, Microsoft Ignite Virtual is what you'll have the opportunity to take advantage of in this first week in March. So go in, sign up, and again, watch those sessions, and hopefully there'll be lots and lots of news coming out from that. We'll be able to update you with that when it becomes available. Now, another interesting piece of news that came out just before this, Microsoft had a major product launch around something it's calling Viva. Now, the interesting thing here is that Viva is sort of around four pillars, so something called Viva Topics, Connections, Learning, and Insights. Now, not all of them are available immediately, and I suppose if you have a close look at these, they look like a lot of stuff that Microsoft is already providing through Teams. Now, there's lots of comments, there's lots of feedback from people out there, and again, expressing that sort of opinion. So I'll leave you to go and have a look at that. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can go and have a look at the individual videos, see what your thoughts are on it, and get involved with it. And again, if you can bring some of that into your tenant as well, the stuff that we have access to already, I'd be doing that just so you're across it. Now, my take on this is that this is sort of another step away from the traditional on-premises files and folders storage type concept. So if you're still locked in that sort of world, then again, the world is really accelerating past that. It's moving to sort of an intranet that responds to your actions. It will surface information that is based on your interactions with the information, so relevancy, who you interact with, a bit of a combination of things like Delve and whatnot. So that's sort of the take that I've got of it at a higher level. So again, go and have a look at the specifics. You're going to see basically the ability to, you know, for the AI in the background there to surface, you know, topics of relevance to define things for you. I really like the inbuilt Viva Learning. I think that's going to be a really important aspect to get people up and most productive with the platform. So if you haven't got some sort of learning platform, I'd really be going in there and looking and seeing what that has to offer and when it will become available. But again, just take a step back and have a look at this in light of the fact of, you know, it was only a number of years ago that we had files and folders and everybody would be opening and closing and attaching. And we've sort of moved to this new world where Teams is the operating system. We're doing all our work inside, you know, more or less this one app. We're doing meetings, we're doing chat, we're doing conversations, collaboration, documents, all of that sort of stuff is happening without really having to worry about the structure. A lot of the automation and AI has been brought into that. So again, I see this as a very important step further away from the old approach, the old thinking. So again, my advice to you is if you're not considering this, thinking about the changes that this will bring to your productivity environment, especially in the age of remote workers, then it's worth having a look at. So again, I'll put the link in the show notes. Go and have a look at what Microsoft Viva is all about. And we should expect to see more announcements and more in-depth when it comes to Ignite this week. Now, one of the other interesting things that I saw is that many people would have said that Microsoft's voice assistant known as Cortana was sort of dead and buried. Well, it's interesting that they're now rolling this into some of their services like Outlook on the mobile. So I'll put the link in the show notes here. It's worthwhile looking, but we can get Cortana to assist us now in Outlook. So it can read emails, it can answer messages, it can set appointments, manage meetings, do that sort of thing all with voice. Now, my understanding is that the voice assistant here is independent of the device. So it's independent of Siri and Google Voice or whatever. So again, the idea here is that Microsoft's using the capabilities in its backend and its cloud, the AI, and working with the voice assistant to be able to manipulate and work with data in something like Outlook. We expect this to grow into other things like Teams and so on. So go and have a look, turn it on, how to play with it. I really like the read my email stuff. I think that's really good when you're on the go. I think it makes a lot of sense on a mobile device, again, when you can't necessarily use your hands. But will it have a major place for us going forward? Don't know. It'd be very interesting to see. It'd be interesting to see whether Microsoft go down the path of maybe integrating with Alexa or, you know, Google Home or something, so that you can get your corporate emails read to you over those home assistants. But it again underlines the importance of the voice component in our modern environment. So the way that we're beginning to interact more and more with devices, with technology now, is with our voice. And that certainly is improving in leaps and bounds. So go and have a look at the new capabilities for Cortana rolled into Outlook. Some good informational video how-tos. Go and turn that feature on. Go have a play with it as well. I've used it. I think it's very good for those of you who are on the go or who, you know, want to interact without touching the device. So again, go and have a play with that and let me know what you think. Now, the SolariGate issues around security are basically beginning to wind up. Microsoft's got a blog post here about turning the page. Worthwhile to have a read, bit of a summary. I think Microsoft's sort of, you know, tying a ribbon around this and saying, look, we've done as much as we can. These are our investigations. Worthwhile to get an understanding of, you know, what has happened, what has transpired, where Microsoft has done its analysis, and what it's come up with. So I encourage you to go and read that, and this is going to be one of the major changes that we see in security, making people think differently, different approach. And if you're not taking security seriously, you really need to, because at the end of the day, the attackers are out there, they're growing in their capabilities, and they're targeting all sorts of users. So again, make sure that you do have all your security set up, enable double check, and again, beware of these sort of foreign attacks that seem to be growing in our environments today. Now, there are some nice enhancements to Microsoft Teams as well. Probably the best one that I've seen come out is the ability to pop out apps and tabs. So if you're working with an app inside Teams, there should be in the top right-hand corner now, you've got the ability to pop that end into an independent window. So we can now start using our desktop app and have multiple windows that allow us to access different sorts of information. So I'll put a link in the show notes again for you to go and have a look at that. But the capabilities of the Microsoft Teams client is improving, and it's adding the capabilities. And as I mentioned before, it's moving to this concept of basically being an operating system. It is the window or the interface, or, you know, even more so than the browser, for users to access all the information they need in Microsoft 365. Now, if you are managing devices, Microsoft has announced the preview of Endpoint Manager's settings catalog. So if you've been creating policies in Intune and Endpoint Security, you'll know there are lots and lots of options. There's compliance policies, configuration policies, endpoint security, for ASR baselines, there's just so many. So beginning to roll these all up into a catalog where you can just select the items that you want and roll them all into one policy rather than having to create a number of independent policies, I think is a quite handy feature. So again, if you have a look, it gives you the capability to create one policy and select all the features that you want and roll it into there. Currently in preview, so if you are doing device management, I'd suggest you go in and have a look at this. I think this is going to basically be a very, very important component for those who are managing devices in the Microsoft 365 space. Now, one of the other security things is that basic authentication is on by default in most tenants. It's now being turned off in newer tenants, but for a lot of existing tenants, it's currently still on. If you haven't gone in and disabled it, you really should, because it only supports legacy applications like POP and IMAP, and that can allow attackers to run things like spray attacks on there. Now, Microsoft has announced they were going to begin disabling basic auth for Exchange Online in the second half of 2021. So they're basically pushing that back a little bit because of the pandemic. So what they're going to do is they're going to start disabling basic auth in tenants looking at the interaction. So if people are using basic auth, then they're not going to turn it off. But if you aren't using it, then it's probably going to be disabled by Microsoft automatically. So again, their plan is to start disabling basic auth for tenants not using Basic Auth. So again, it will assess your tenant, and if you're not using it, then it'll start disabling it. And then at some point in the future, it'll look at obviously also disabling that for environments that are running Basic Auth. So remember that you do need to go in and double check this. Typically, it's the older style SMTP, POP, IMAP, and so on. So if you haven't, again, do some research, have a look. I'll put a link again to the article so you can go and have a look. Basic Auth will be turned off completely at some stage down the track. It's beginning to happen now. It's on a slower rollout because of the current pandemic. But go into your tenant and make sure that you are looking to disable or remove those basic authentication devices in there. So a couple of blog posts from me that I think are worthwhile reading. I have one here that email overrides are not best practice. We see a lot of people who, for some reason, complain that some of the emails they're receiving end up in spam or are being blocked or whatever. And rather than address that, you know, with the policy or adjust that, what they're doing is they're going in and they're whitelisting those email addresses or those domains at various places in their policy. Now, this is definitely not best practice. It's creating a hole that an attacker could exploit. So again, some articles from Microsoft and some confirmation from them that these are certainly not best practices. So whitelisting anything really is something that shouldn't be done. You need to evaluate why certain emails are ending up in the quarantine or the junk folders, rather than, like I said, just whitelisting things in bulk. So go and have a look at that. Lots of links I've put in there to show you the policies and the options that Microsoft recommends. Now, the last one I've got for you is a blog post I wrote about Microsoft 365 mailbox capacities and sizes. A lot of confusion out there as to how much each SKU provides. So what I've done here is I've broken them down for you. So the basic business mailboxes, you're going to get a 50 gig primary mailbox and a 50 gig archive, giving you a total of 100. Now, when you get to the enterprise plans E3, that primary mailbox will increase to 100 gig, and then the archive will become unlimited. And the way it adds that is it adds it at 100 gigs at a time. So it is unlimited, but you get 100 gigs. When you get to 100 gigs, they add another 100 gigs and so on. Now, the only variation on this is a plan like Microsoft 365 Business Premium, which also includes what they call the Exchange Online archiving add-on. And this means that the archive, like E3, then becomes unlimited. Now, this means that a Microsoft 365 Business Premium has an arrangement of a 50 gig primary mailbox and an unlimited cloud storage. So effectively, it is an unlimited inbox when you look at what's saved across the primary and the archive, which is in the cloud. However, remember that the difference between that and E3 is the primary mailbox and an E3 is a 100 gig limit. Now, the only time you get issues if you, for example, are downgrading from E3 to Business Premium is if the user has more than 50 gig in their primary mailbox, which is typically synced to their on-prem environment, their OST file. So if it is, again, you can set retention policies to move that data into the cloud archive and then upgrade the license at the back end. I've only ever seen that once, but remember, at its core, Microsoft 365 Business Premium is going to provide you an unlimited inbox. That unlimited inbox is split between a 50 gig primary mailbox, which is typically synchronized to the local environment, and an unlimited cloud-based archive mailbox. And that article there hopefully spells it out for everybody to make that nice and clear. So I recommend that you go in and read that. All right, so again, we're looking for lots of announcements from the Microsoft Ignite. I'll be watching that and reporting back to you with any interesting topics that are found. Remember, also, as I said at the beginning of the episode, if you do know somebody who'd like to come on the podcast or would make a good subject for the podcast, please contact me, director@CIAOps.com. And that will be allow me to, again, make this as interesting as possible, as relevant as I can for people. So if you do have a suggestion, please, by all means, or you do want to volunteer yourself to come on, love to hear from you. Please take that opportunity again, director@ciaops.com. Now, with that, you can also find everything about what's going on that I find in the cloud via my Twitter handle, @directorcia. And keep in touch with me at my blog, blog.ciaops.com, where I do publish all this technical information and the discoveries that I make when it comes to the Microsoft Cloud. So with that, why don't we get into this episode's interview? So I'm joined by Adam Lang from Microsoft. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you very much for having me, Robert.
So as always, we'll get Adam firstly to introduce himself, let us know what his current role is, and give us a bit of a background as to how he came into that role. So if you could do that for us, Adam, that'd be fantastic.
Sure thing, not a problem. Hi, everybody. My name's Adam. I'm currently the Microsoft ISV channel manager for Microsoft here in Australia. So what that actually means is I've got the beautiful role of being able to work with partners and focus on partners and independent software vendors to really try and help them commercialize their business and build out go-to-market strategies with those ISVs across Australia. I work closely in the Azure stack, so quite closely in the Azure side of the business. But due to the nature of ISVs, I certainly get across Microsoft Teams, Microsoft Office 365, and also Microsoft Dynamics and Microsoft Power Platform, which makes it a really, really interesting role. Certainly means I'm diverse in nature, not technical enough to be an expert, but certainly technical enough to be dangerous, but really focus on the business side of the technology for Microsoft. I've got an amazing team that kind of helped me do that. And looking to always kind of acquire new independent software vendors to bring into Microsoft and really, really understand partners. Probably spent the first 15, 20 years of my career working on the partner side before I joined Microsoft. So I really kind of came in to disrupt the way Microsoft thinks about partner and the way we work with partner, and with a view that I don't want to distract my clients from selling, that I understand that you've got to have a really strong sell with strategy and kind of to work with them to help them sell and grow their business.
All right. So again, we want to probably focus on the ISV side of things to give people a better idea of that. Now, can you give us a good definition or a good example or some key characteristics that you see of what a successful ISV is? Is it, a developer who spends their time totally engrossed in code 24/7? Is it someone who basically gets out the duct tape and the bobby pins and the safety pins and clips everything together for a business? What's a good definition that people could relate to when it comes to today's, modern ISV?
Sure. So, it's a great question and it's a big question. So a modern ISV really needs to understand their client. So in order to be a success in the market, in a really competitive market in Australia, you've really have to have solved a business problem. So the ISVs that I've worked with that are really, really successful, of course they have best of breed technology. They really, really do. They have built some technology that is really easy to use. The end user experience is seamless. It works. Obviously, uptime's fine. It's secure. We take those things as basics. But in order for them to really elevate themselves to the next level, they have to have a really strong go-to-market strategy. And what I mean by that is the best technology, if nobody knows about it, nobody uses it. So what I encourage all of my ISVs is, of course, invest in the platform, invest in the security, but invest in a really strong sell with strategy. And what I mean by that is rely on your partner network, rely on your partnerships. You don't have to do everything alone. Work with people like Microsoft, work with people within your partner community, work with managed service providers who have end customers. So there's integration with what they're already doing and your ISV solution. So that way you've got a single source of truth. So that way you've got your platform that you've built out or your solution that you've built out really adds value to that end customer. So if you have an amazing platform with an amazing go-to-market strategy and an amazing ability to get that product to market, you've got a winning formula.
All right. So do you see that ISVs have come from typically a coding, a developer background, or are they more likely, you know, maybe a business in technology that's been working with customers for a while that has created a solution and now is looking to commercialize it? What's the more common path these days to being a successful ISV? Is it something that you've sort of started since day one and you're into code and you know code? Or is it, to an extent, something you've sort of stumbled across and built up and all of a sudden you realize you've got a really good solution that yep. could obviously service, you know, quite a few customers?
Yeah, so there's a real 50-50 split. The first type of person is that true evangelist. That's that technologist, the true technologist that believes that they can write the next great piece of software and that piece of software will make an impact. And that definitely can be successful and certainly works. The other 50% is the person who's usually worked in industry and they've been disappointed or frustrated or concerned about the platform or the solution or the technology they're working with and says, I'm not a technical person by nature, but I've worked in this industry. I understand this industry. And with that, I actually think I can build something better. I can actually make an impact and solve this problem. And by solving that problem, they usually whiteboard something quite creative. It's usually no coding at that point at all. And usually at that point, they reach out to a technologist or to a Microsoft or to any of the other, you know, providers out there and go, this is a concept and this is an idea. Quite often, actually, at that point, they actually reach out to a venture capitalist at that point and kind of say, I've got an idea, I've got a concept. I think I can solve a problem. At what point I need some funding, I need some money, and then some introductions are made at that point. And then they're introduced to a technical person who helps build out that code, build out that solution alongside them. And that is the beginning of a beautiful partnership. And that is that is the beginning of getting something to market. So it really is that two sides of the boat.
All right. So when it comes to the technical side of, you know, bringing the app or solution to market, is it something that's, you know, generally developed in something like C or C++, or, you know, is it something that's done in Power Automate or some of these more low-code solutions that are out there today from Microsoft?
My Microsoft answer would be, of course, Microsoft has all the solutions and all the answers, but I don't believe that's actually a fair answer. I believe the answer is if it's born from a technical background, it's usually built on the platform that the technologist is the most comfortable writing that particular piece of code on. You're right, though, Robert. The way the world is heading, it is so exciting to see the reduction and reliance on hardcore coding. And we've got that low code, no code kind of solutions. And even to the point where I know it's a little off track that I've got two young kids and I'm sending them off to do code camp because I see that the future is going to be in that. But with automation and with tools like Power Automate and with tools within Dynamics that actually help you develop some of that code itself, you don't need to be a traditional .NET coder or hardcore coder. Having said that, when you are building some really complex solutions and you really need to integrate into large enterprise solutions, you certainly need to go back to code and certainly understand code and be able to read code.
Well, I think that's certainly a given in this day and age that, you know, coding is such an important concept even for the IT pro and even for the customer to be able to enunciate the process that would need to be, you know, taken to solve a problem. So having some grip on coding, I agree, is something that's very, very important. And Microsoft does give us, you know, a lot of solutions out there. Now, when your ISV, you know, obviously you've got an idea, a solution or problem, and you're addressing it in a, you know, technical manner with you know, maybe somebody inside your organization or, as you say, as a partner, once you've sort of got it to that alpha, that beta sort of stage, what's the recommendation? Is it to sort of go to market or do I test it internally? Do I look for a, you know, a beta group of users to test this? What's sort of the next step after I've, you know, got maybe a proof of concept working that it seems to all work and do what I want, and I actually want real, you know, people to get it, get their hands on it and see what it's like to actually, you know, use this thing? Is it we do this in a small manner? Is that sort of the next step?
So, yeah, proof of concept is always the number one thing. But even before that, and obviously I'm not a lawyer, once I've got an idea, make sure that you protect your IP, because if you're going to go to even to a small market segment, you don't want someone to kind of steal that concept and idea from you. So let's just assume that you've registered the IP, you're protected, and it's yours, so no one can take that idea off you. If we took an example of a proof of concept, yes, I would certainly go to a very small group of people within that particular industry vertical and utilize their innate knowledge of that industry vertical to trial it, to test it, and let them know what their feedback is on it. Once you've done that, you certainly scale it out and grow it. Like any good software, you're only ever as good as your last version. So even you might be version 0.9 and then you get to version 1.0, and then you kind of create add-ons, you create APIs, you make sure that that particular solution is open enough as well so they can integrate into other platforms. But by all means, a smart start small, make sure that it's very polished, make sure that the people within that proof of concept group are trusted. And you've got a good group that covers more than one, like you want someone from finance, you want someone from marketing, you want someone from the end user, you want someone from a customer, to make sure that it's really tested from beginning to end and that experience is seamless the whole way through. Once you've got some green ticks on that, by all means, then you know your product is ready. And also, you can also tell from the feedback from that as well that, you know, you can almost see from the smile on their face that you've actually taken some pain away from the day. You've got some, you know, time back in the day that's not repeating autonomous tasks. Once you've done that, you know your product is there and it's ready. And then sure, I would then really kind of put some tweaks on that commercial go-to-market plan, that sell with strategy, that sales plan, and get it to market. And get it to market hard and fast at that point. Because once it's there, you want to really want to hit the market hard so you can get that, you know, first to market advantage and then grow from there. Yes, exactly right. And that's really important, especially if you're disrupting. If you've created something that's disruptive, you want to make sure that, you know, you disrupt hard and you disrupt fast and you really, really, you know, make an impact.
All right. So in general, I mean, it's very hard, I know, to put, you know, numbers on this, but on average, how long do you see that it takes from somebody with a concept to getting to a, you know, a proof of concept, a working proof of concept that we are ready to take to a, you know, a version 1.0 going forward? Is that a, you know, 1 year, 5 years? I mean, what sort of time period do you normally see that it takes to get to, you know, release 1.0?
Again, it's a difficult question to answer and a great question. For the audience listening, it's actually getting faster and faster. So every year, it kind of the gap gets smaller and smaller. A few months ago, we would be deploying software. You're right, it would take 12, 18 months before it even be ready to market. But with the ability of low code, no code, speed of tools on the internet, the access to people globally to be able to support you on those builds, 3 to 6 months now to get that version, not 1.0, but at least that 0.9 ready. So at least that small proof of concept is there. And the reason why it's a shorter period of time is there's obviously a financial investment that goes into it. You don't want to be throwing hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars away onto an idea and a concept that doesn't really hit the mark. So within 3 to 6 months, if your product is not coming to a sort of fruition where at least a small select number of users can trial it and test it, I'd be starting to get some red flags and going, okay, green, amber, red. I need to understand why we're not getting something, you know, pen to paper here, so to speak, to use old school terms, or why I can't see some development come out of this. The old way of doing waterfall development is going with Agile and DevOps. It's certainly being a lot faster now, and we're getting product releases faster, which means we're getting products out a lot faster now as well. Also important to note for those listening, there's support around that. So if you do have a great idea, you don't need to do it all yourself. So to get that speed to market, rely on the people in your network to kind of build out that, you know, ability to get your product to market as fast as possible.
Okay, so at what point is the recommendation that you would, you know, get Microsoft involved? Is it, you know, at the conceptual stage, the 0.9 stage, the 1 stage? What's the, do you find in your experience, is the best time for, say, someone who's come up with this idea, looking to, you know, do the ISV thing and whatever, what point in that process should they be looking to engage with Microsoft?
Oh, I love people to engage with this as early as possible, to be honest. I love hearing about, I mean, again, my role is in that startups area. So, of course, once it's really big and mature, it's moved on to a different part of Microsoft. So from my role and my team, getting them in as early as possible and understanding what they're trying to do is certainly, we encourage that. Again, keep in mind that we might be able to support by introducing them to agencies, to venture capitalists who can support them on that journey as well. So it's not just Microsoft as the be-all and end-all. Sometimes that introduction or knowing about what we can do to support you in the marketplace can help you kind of grow the product. If you're already through a development stage and you think, you know what, we really need to lean on the Microsoft sellers, lean on the Microsoft account executives, lean on the team of Microsoft that have got industry specific knowledge, by all means, our team is there to support as well. And we can certainly facilitate introductions as well. But the earlier we know about you, the earlier we can certainly assist you as well, whether that be architectural support, whether it be selling support. I mean, we really encourage and open to that.
All right, so again, probably another general sort of question, but in your experience, is the person who comes up with the idea who, you know, this is the problem that I want to solve, is that person the right person generally to take the product forward from version one forward and do the marketing? Or do you find that it's better for them to get, you know, professional marketers or, you know, someone who maybe is a little bit less technical or away from the industry? You know, is the sort of the developer or the original concept developer the right person to continue that through the into the release stage, do you find?
No, I believe a really diverse bunch of people within the team creates the best amount of success. So I try and get as many people from different diversities will give you the best input and then definitely the best output. Just because you've got the idea doesn't mean you're the best marketer or the best salesperson or the best technologist. By surrounding yourself by people who are diverse in nature will definitely give you the best outcome.
All right. So let's say that, you know, we're going along well. We have got this to a, you know, a version one or to a 0.9 and we're ready to get out there. Our initial audience, beta testers, are happy with it. What's a strategy that you find would work well when it comes to, you know, getting this product out there in the market? Is it something that you would suggest, you know, using an organic growth word of mouth, or is it, you know, trying to come up with a big bang launch, or is it maybe something viral? Do things like, you know, what works well? Is it, you know, video tutorials on what the product is? How do you get the word out to obviously get, you know, move it to a more mass market than it would be when you first, you know, developed the product?
Referenceability is always the key when you're trying to get your product to market. I know it's hard. It's you need a reference to be referenceability, which is where that proof of concept really comes into handy if you've solved that initially. But a great referenceability and a great case study around your product certainly helps. From that point, utilizing things like Microsoft Marketplace, we certainly find helps. Using social media channels absolutely help. It also depends on your kind of financial budget as well. So do a big bang approach, great, it'll work. You've got to be mindful that you need enough kind of money in the bank to pay the staff and pay the team. But by all means, certainly engaging a really great marketing agency to push your product, get it into the right marketplaces across Asia and even Asia Pacific. Don't just limit yourself to Australia. I mean, if you've got a solution, you might be able to utilize organizations that can help you push your product throughout Asia Pac. Don't let language, the English language, limit you. So do that as well. but by all means, I utilize the same diversity your team, the diversity of channels out there to get your product to market. But the number one thing is having that reference ability in a case study that validates that your product solves a problem is certainly the right thing to do.
Background audience. Do you find that people who develop these solutions, are they serial in their approach? Are they solving problem after problem after problem? Or generally, are they able to ride the coattails of maybe one core solution and then have add-ons or variations on that? Is it a case of they develop something, go, that's great, out to market, we continue on with that, but now I'm going to go off and solve another problem?
Certainly, we have serial entrepreneurs or serial problem solvers. They identify a problem in multiple sectors, and then they build out that formula and that plan. They've got that success formula that they know to get from A to B to C to D. And they certainly have serial or a number of different products that they develop for the market, and they do that successfully. On the flip side, if you were an ISV vendor who came up with a product that was literally the next big thing, it would consume all of your time and energy, and you'd probably throw all your weight behind that. But ISVs certainly get purchased, especially if they integrate into other larger platforms. They build out a product, they build out an offering, they've proven to the market that it actually does solve the product, solve the problem, apologies. And once it's done that, sometimes some bigger organizations purchase that product and become just another module within their product as well. And when that happens, the founder of that business, he or she may then go on to do it again, or they may integrate into that business again.
So are you seeing the number of ISV people who are providing these sort of solutions? Is that something that's growing, or is it consolidating around a certain set of individuals with backgrounds and whatever? What's your experience in this market? Is it growing? Are there more opportunities for people to come in if they do see a problem that needs solving?
Immense opportunity. Without doubt, it is probably one of the fastest growing segments of the market. Digital transformation continues to kind of grow, and especially throughout COVID, and you heard before, like obviously I'm working from home with COVID, ideas are flourishing and people have the ability to think of ways to improve and do better and kind of work in a fashion that is more autonomous and give them that ability to do it. So more people that you would never expect have come up with ideas and concepts around technology to solve those challenges. And it is continuing to grow and growing at a rapid, rapid rate, which makes it so exciting from Microsoft's perspective and obviously from where I work within Microsoft. No 2 days are the same. It just makes it absolutely fantastic. And it's so encouraging to see that people coming from school and coming from university and coming from all sorts of backgrounds reach out and connect with us. And they really are making a positive impact. And they're really developing solutions that are really, really doing well. And I'm lucky to be part of that journey.
So obviously this is and has been a major part of Microsoft's ecosystem for a long time. So they've always been about developers and code and the tools to achieve that. And we see these low code solutions, rolling into Microsoft 365, Dynamics, Power Automate, the Power Apps and all that sort of thing being available in the environment today. We've also got obviously the high level coding that's also possible. There's such a variety that's out there.
Yes.
If you were to give advice to people who may not be, brought up in a code or a dev sort of environment, and they do want to, dip their toe in and understand a bit around the coding and, how this may make sense, not necessarily write it themselves, but I think having that basis is a good place to start. What would you recommend that they have a look at? Should they dive into, the Dynamics, the Power Automate, those sort of things, low-code solutions, or maybe was it better to dive into, a programming language that, will give them some sort of basics around understanding the flow and what it takes to build an application?
I think understanding the foundations is critical. Even going back all the way back to the days of DOS and NT4, those same foundations that we learned when we were a lot younger still are valid today, and having that really core understanding. There are plenty of great materials online, which I encourage your users and your listeners to reach out to. Power Up Foundations, Azure Foundations, Dynamics Foundations. They're not difficult courses. They're all online, but it gives you that real understanding of what each of those products actually do. And don't forget, there's more than just Microsoft. I know I'm passionate about Microsoft, but having that real understanding and that foundational understanding of what coding is and what it can do is so, so important. The internet is just such a vast plethora of information that I would encourage them to spend just not more than half an hour understanding what it could do. What I encourage some of the people early in career in the Microsoft environment is really getting behind Power Apps. And the reason why I say Power Apps is because it gives you a really broad understanding of technology. It touches a little bit of Microsoft Dynamics, which is what you said before. It touches a little bit of Microsoft Azure. But the foundation of that is something called CDS. And if you understand that, all of a sudden you kind of understand the way business operates and the way data operates. And if you understand the way data moves and data operates from the beginning to end with information in through to information out, that will certainly give them a great foundation and a great understanding of, you know, how they want to design the possible solution that they're thinking about.
So just for everybody out there, CDS is the common data service. This obviously is something you can integrate with around the, you know, Power Platform that gives you, you know, that ability to store and manage data. Again, plenty of information around there on that gives you that, you know, next level up when you want to do and use that sort of information. So I think that the main thing obviously is not the language that you speak, it's the logic, it's the ability to, you know, put together sentences that make sense and ask the right questions. So any little bit of programming can help. Like I said, Power Automate, Power Apps, and that certainly give you that base without necessarily having to worry too much about the low level writing the code, compiling and all that sort of stuff. So generally a very good suggestion. I think most people out there hopefully listening do have access to a Microsoft 365 tenant. They can go in and start solving and looking at solutions to automate their lives, make things easier. If not, you've also got things like If This Then That. You've also got Zapier. There's a number of those sort of plug and play style tools out there, and then, you know, basically take it from there. But I think, again, reinforcing that coding for everybody is a very important aspect. You don't have to be a coder, but understanding the fundamentals, because we really live in such an age of software at this moment in time and going forward. It's obviously a key skill. All right, so we're drawing towards the end of our time here, Adam. If you were to summarize for our audience, you know, what is the benefit to them looking at, you know, getting into the ISV space or maybe, you know, solving that particular problem that they've been thinking about for a while that they know would help others as well? You know, why should they invest the time and the effort to go down a bit of an ISV track if they've sort of been perhaps more in the operations than the dev side of things? You know, what sort of opportunities have you seen with, you know, people you've worked with that have been able to take these sort of solutions all the way through to market and then obviously get a successful outcome for themselves and for the business?
For a start, the beauty of the ISV track is you don't need to have come from a highly technical background. So it's open to everybody. So one of the big things that I always tell all the people I speak to is trust in yourself and trust in your ability or back yourself. But by doing that, the technology is there to open up doors. So the reason why you should be doing something like that is because it's that plane of glass that you can see out into the entire world. You can do it from the comfort of your home, but you've got that global reach. If you've got an idea, if you've got a concept, that space of being an ISV really, really allows you to kind of open up your mind to solve challenges and solve problems. At no point should the technology ever limit what you do. You should be able to devise and create something so amazing and so fantastic. And that ISV space allows you to do that. So don't think of it as being just a coder behind a computer. All of a sudden, you're working with people or working alongside people from all walks of life all over the planet. And there is nothing more exciting than that. So no longer do you need to be the person just behind the screen trying to write a piece of code. You can be the person who can, you can almost become your own entrepreneur very, very quickly. You can do it 2 hours a day, you can do it 24 hours a day. You can do it to solve something that will hopefully have a huge impact that will leave the world better. It could be something is for environmental well-being. It might be something for financial well-being. The world is so large and so diverse that by sitting there and thinking of an idea and coming up with a concept, it is as free as you want it to be. And don't let anyone limit you and tell you that it can't be done. By all means, that ability to do something new and do something terrific is in that ISV space. And you have support with you. There's a whole network of people in Australia and around the world that can support you with an idea and make it go from an idea on a whiteboard to something that is on every single person's, you know, mobile phone, on their iPad, on their Microsoft Surface device globally. And that in itself is just a phenomenal thing. It's something that should inspire passion, should put a smile on your face, and you really can make an impact.
I think I agree with you that obviously the opportunity is there in this day and age. You also get that scalability. So if you're someone who's typically, you know, worked in the IT pro or the admin side of things, it's typically an hourly sort of commitment. Whereas if you do develop apps or solve problems using software, you can leverage that solution many, many times over and obviously help yourself to the revenue that can come along with that leveraging as well. So there are lots of benefits with that model. And as Adam mentioned, you don't have to throw away what you're doing right now. You can obviously do it as a side gig, improve it. And I think there are plenty of examples of people that have done very successful apps on the side that have gone on to provide, you know, very handy revenue for them as well, even if it's not, you know, their main income. The opportunity certainly is there. And now that we have the, you know, the ecosystem of, you know, a platform, a common platform like Azure, Microsoft 365, Dynamics and so on, makes it very easy to build solutions that can sit on those platforms and appeal to a very wide audience. So again, lots and lots of opportunities certainly in that space. All right, Adam, so I thank you very much for your time. Do you have any resources that you would recommend people take advantage of? And also if you could provide people out there with your contact details or the best way for them to follow along with what you're doing or get in touch if they do have further questions about what we've spoken about today.
Yeah, in terms of resources, that's a really difficult one. I follow a lot of industry-specific publications. So if they're from an ISV perspective, if you're interested in developing something, I would be reading up on industry-specific publications. I love, from a personal perspective, reading about people who have, you know, built successful businesses as well, and from a growth mindset and things like that. I'm really passionate about reading about that because I'm a strong believer. If you believe in yourself, you can believe in your idea and you can make anything possible. In terms of contact details, by all means, look me up on LinkedIn. I think it says Adam Lang AU on LinkedIn. My email address, Robert, I don't know, are you comfortable with me giving my Microsoft.com email address out?
That's whatever you're comfortable with, because you're the one that's going to be receiving them. So if you're happy for me to do that, I'll put the link.
I'm happy with that. If you've got an idea or if you've got a concept or just want to run a couple of ideas off me, my email is quite easy. It's adamlang@microsoft.com. So it's nice and easy, one word. By all means, shoot me a note. I'm pretty good on email, but also on LinkedIn if you want to follow anything. But as I said, we encourage ideas. We encourage these net new concepts coming to market. Microsoft is really keen to work alongside you in partnership with you to help you support you grow your solution, your idea. So please feel free to reach out and connect. It's that human interaction and that human touch that makes a big difference. And I'm a big believer in that.
Excellent. All right. Well, I will take this opportunity on behalf of all listeners to thank Adam for the time and the information that he has shared with us. I think there's a lot for people to think about, even if you aren't necessarily someone who's written code. I think that the further we get into the future, the more that code is really going to become an absolute necessity, no matter what your role is. And if you're a managing director, you're going to have some concept of code, because so much of our world today is built on code and the interconnectivity between systems, which again, rolls back to code. So certainly take that time. And if you do see an opportunity there, a problem that can be solved, again, don't hesitate to look at the Microsoft options around the ISV market, what can be done. And especially, you know, there is so much that is quick and easy to spin up inside Azure.
that you can do for a few dollars as your proof of concept and get it out to a few people to at least test the waters. So lots of great resources there from Microsoft. Also great information from Adam. I'll make sure that I put all the information in the show notes so people can take advantage of that. And again, I'll take this opportunity to thank Adam very much for his time with us today. So again, Adam, thank you very much for that.
My absolute pleasure. Look forward to hearing from you, readers, listeners.
All right, no problem. So again, thank you very much to everybody out there who's been listening to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Microsoft 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selections available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.